Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget J. Paul Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Today, we are going to talk about air quality in the city of Buffalo and very much focused on the east side of Buffalo. A couple of studies that are underway that are going to focus on that. And to give us an outline, we have a couple of guests with us today. Dr. Meng Wong is at the University of Buffalo in their Department of Epidemiology and Environmental Health. Dr. Wong, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also with us, Samantha Hidalgo. She's the Public Health Program Manager for Buffalo Center for Health Equity. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Samantha, I'll let you kind of give us the overview before we get into some of the more specifics with the scientists in our room here this morning. Well, there are actually two studies that are taking a look at air quality. Give us the outline of it, please.
Sure. So the Buffalo Center for Health Equity operates more in the recruitment arm than we do the scientific arm, but part of our responsibility with both of these studies is to ensure that they are equitable for the communities that we're going to be involved. I'll start with Dr. Yu's because she's not here.
Okay.
But Dr. Yu is a professor in the Department of Geography at UB. She was awarded EPA funding actually quite a while ago, but was announced and formally started earlier this year. There was a big press conference at Delavan Grider. Some folks might remember that announcement about EPA funding kind of coming to Buffalo. The purpose of her study is to install air sensors outside of people's homes. We're looking at 30 homes a year for 1 year. You are compensated for that year. Mm. And then a different cohort of 30 households, again, being compensated for 1 year. So 2 years in total of collecting information. Her interest is in ambient air quality. So that's just outdoor air quality. There are EPA sensors in the region, but none of them are located in the city of Buffalo.
There's three.
One by the airport, one closer to Niagara Falls, and then one just a little bit outside of South Buffalo. And so the average of those is what is on our weather report when it says, like, oh, the air quality is 2 or 4 or 20. It's an average of those three sensors, but again, none of which are located actually in the city limits or on the east side of Buffalo. And so looking at her study, trying to get households, we're still recruiting for that study. We are targets right now are 14215, 213, 211, 212, and I believe 203.
Okay.
So we're still trying to get homes. There's about 15 people already enrolled in the study. And one of the things that I think makes it pretty easy to join is that it's incredibly low impact on the people participating. You don't even need like a formalized consent form because the device is outside of their home. The only requirements are that you have Wi-Fi and an outdoor outlet. The research team installs the air sensor. If you choose to, you can actually download the app for the sensor and kind of see in real time what the air quality in your neighborhood is at your home. But if that is scary to you or you don't want to do that, you certainly don't have to. That data is kind of automatically sent to Dr. Yu and her team, and she's able to analyze it fairly quickly. The second study, we're here with Dr. Wong from the School of Public Health, Department of Epidemiology. This is an indoor air quality study focusing on 55 and up seniors in Black and African American households on the east side. This is an indoor air quality study, which can sometimes be conflated with Dr. Yu's, but that's outdoor. This is indoor. And the purpose of this study is a survey dedicated more towards understanding people's, I don't know, what would you say, behaviors around?
Yeah, house environment.
Right.
Et cetera, yeah. and also looking at how people's behavior in response to different type of environment conditions.
If you could, I know there's a lot that goes into putting a project like this together, but if you can, lead us into how perhaps this all started for you. I would assume that we know about social determinants of health. We hear about statistics on the east side of Buffalo, especially when it comes to various diseases. But what about, from your perspective, what you wanted to get focused on and what really kind of intrigued you about the possibilities here?
Yeah, so the reason we developed these two studies is really because we know that, so we have done some preliminary studies before, and we have some mappings understanding the spatial distribution of air quality in Buffalo area, and we notice that the air quality east side is typically higher than the other area, so it's kind of environmental injustice problem we have identified. So the problem is that even though we have this information, but we really don't have data to support it, right? So that is why Dr. Yu's study really play an important role to enrich the data ability to increase awareness and preparedness for the people on the east side of Buffalo area. So they understand, when extreme event come, what they're going to do, if they need to do something, right, for it. Yeah, so that is a background for it. And back to the indoor quality problem, why we focus on both outdoor and indoor is because for indoor air quality, we already know that it's different from outdoor pollution because people may do cooking, may do house cleaning. So all these activities can potentially increase indoor air quality at home. And also, notice that it's like infiltration problem, right? So, for example, for the the underserved communities, they have a poor housing problem. Their houses are usually old.
The housing stock is old, right?
Right. So, in that case, you can imagine that the outdoor air quality pollution can easily patronate indoor.
Okay.
So potentially increase the level of air pollution. So that's why we want to understand, indoor pollution is more relevant to human subject. People spend most of the time indoor than outdoor. So whether the indoor pollution is really a problem, more directly impact the people.
When it comes to indoor pollution, though, I'm also thinking about mold issues and maybe dander that had built up over the years. Are those things that just aren't, again, there's an assumption going in that that's going to be a prevalent element of this, or is that maybe not something that you're really focused on?
Well, mold is a different story.
Okay.
Because we are more focusing on general indoor air quality.
All right.
So it could be more related to people's cooking activity.
All right.
If they use burning stuff, stove cooking,
sure.
This kind of.
Okay. Yeah. So mold is not necessarily part of it. Yeah, it's not really that you're monitoring for here. It's interesting, though, you're recruiting also for people to participate in your study. But it's interesting to hear the type of purification system that you're going to equip people with. Give us a little bit of detail of what that might entail.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So in this study, we are trying to develop a DIY, do-it-yourself air purifier.
Right.
So the air purifier is pretty simple. It's you build a box with 3 to 4 air filters,
mm-hmm.
that you can easily buy from the shop, and then you add a box fan on top of it. Then you build a cubic. So this DIY air purifier is pretty cheap. It costs only $30 to $50.
Mm-hmm.
So comparing to the commercial air purifier, it may cost $100, right? So we did some preliminary study in our lab, and we find that the DIY air purifier actually works better than the commercial air purifier. Well, yeah. So
hey, you're the scientist, so if you say so. but to that, so then also though, there's going to be a monitoring system installed as well?
Yes. Exactly. So on one hand, we built up this low-cost air purifier. On the other hand, because we focus on elderly participants, so we want to develop a technology that can lower their load to use of this air purifier. So in that way, we develop a sensor-guided air purifier, which means that we will give them an air sensor and let the air sensor to determine whether the air purifier needs to be on or off based on the level of air quality. So in that way, the whole process could be automatic, so there's no load for the elderly participant to operate this. So in that, but it can keep there. We hope that this system will keep their indoor air quality good.
So the monitor is going to have a setting on it to automatically start the purifier.
We can set it up.
Yeah. Okay. What is it going to be monitoring? What specific pollutants will it be looking for? Or what is going to be measured inside the air quality in these homes?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So when we talk about air pollution, it's a very general term. Actually,
sure.
Air pollution includes many air pollutants. Like the EPA, so websites, they define the 6 criteria pollutants, right? So we're typically interested in fine particulate matter. So fine particulate matter is also called PM2.5. So this is a very tiny particle. The size is smaller than 2.5 micrometer. Mm. So it's easy to inhalate it into our respiratory system and penetrate into our circulation system. So there's very solid evidence showing that PM2.5 can increase the health effect of human subject, generally including cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, cancer, a lot of diseases. So that is why we're typically focusing on this PM2.5, this pollutant. And also we know that in Buffalo area, the PM2.5 level is relatively higher, like compared to other air pollutant, is more issue compared to other pollutant, for example, like ozone or oxides of nitrogen. So they all problem, but not as severe as PM2.5. So that is why like both Dr. Yu and my study is primarily focused on this pollutant.
What, Samantha, again, you do studies so you can find out data, but what are, I have to think there are certain expectations, though, that come out of this. We know, we talked about this at the top, about social determinants of health, and we know a lot of the statistics that are coming out of the East Side when it comes to the health conditions of many people. But what are the expectations here?
I think for us at the center, it's mobilizing community around mitigation efforts, and so as much as we've heard stories about things or anecdotal stories about, you know, this happened or that happened, it's good to have information like what Dr. Yu and Dr. Wang studies provide, because then we can go to Common Council, we can go to the county legislature, the state, the federal government, and say, these are the numbers, right? This is what we are seeing. We've had a commitment from both Dr. Yu and Dr. Wang to look into bigger grants that would then supply mitigation efforts on a local level, which is great, or to do more investigating into other air quality issues. So these are relatively smaller studies, right? Dr. Wang was awarded funding from the Community Health Equity Research Institute at UB, which is primary focus is just to look into health equity research.
Right.
But we would like to expand these studies, right? We would like to be able to look at more things, and mitigation, that's always a concern of ours, is like wanting our communities to be able to thrive, not just survive.
Well, are there certain types of pollutants, though, that we already understand that are perhaps found readily and on the East Side that we're probably going to find out as we go through these studies, that are how prevalent they really are? I mean, I'd take answer from either on that.
I would say lead has always been a big issue in Buffalo. We have some of the highest rates of childhood lead poisoning in the country. As Dr. Wong said, our houses are extremely old. What is it, like 60% of our housing stock was built before 1940,
right?
Which means unless someone was doing renovations, you know, fairly recently, you're going to have older electrical systems, you're going to have older insulation systems, you're going to have a lot more lead dust in these homes. that, I think, coupled with the fact that we have so many renters and very few homeowners, I think Black home ownership is at like an all-time low, around what, 6%? You're going to see just a lot less care of these homes, not because renters don't care, but because their landlords aren't making the necessary changes. So I am interested to see if lead plays a role in any of the things we're investigating. I think that might be a little bit harder because lead tends to be bigger than some of the other things that we're looking at. I mean, just like physically larger.
Right.
But I'm also interested to see too, like, what our soil quality is. Like, we have a lot of contaminated soil on the east side of Buffalo that hasn't necessarily been remediated. I know that there are some projects that are looking into like gardens as a method of like pulling lead from the soil. But I think as the work of Dr. Yu and Dr. Wang expands, I'm interested to kind of see what are some of the things that like we've seen some loose connections to, but can't definitively say like this is causing that.
Doctor, what about for you? I mean, do you have and we heard Samantha talk about lead being a concern, but how about for you? I mean, are there, again, I don't want to lead the research here, but at the same time, there must be an understanding of what is present on the east side.
Yeah. So what I would think also getting more and more important may be the impact from climate change. So actually in my project, another part of the study is to look at whether climate-related factors could also potentially affecting the African-American community.
So, for example, increased temperatures could be a part of it.
Right. So not only temperature. So the basic background is that the EPA has a recent report showing that climate change may particularly impact two groups of minorities. One is African American community, increased by more than 20%, and another one group is Hispanic community, which is slightly lower, about more than 10%. So definitely, African American communities are like nationally, African American communities are broadly impacted by climate change. So back to the climate change is a general term, but definitely temperature is important. So temperature could be related to like heat wave, right? Extreme high temperature heat wave, but can also be extremely low temperature or temperature variability, right? So that is one scope. Another part would be like storm, right? So we live close to the two Great Lakes. So the lake effect storm could potentially affecting Buffalo area. So we are like more broadly looking at a number of climate-related factors on the health effect in this community.
I'm really interested in that how climate change could play be an impact in this. So, you know, how will that read out in your study? What would show you that there is a correlation?
Well, we don't have a result yet. I wouldn't say that. Sorry about that.
Yeah, but I continue to lead the witness here. I apologize.
Yeah, we hope to show some results. But I think the reason we focus on also looking into climate impact is because Buffalo area traditionally be like climate friendly area.
Right, that's been
people may feel that, okay, so this area, because it's close to the Green Lake, temperature may not be a really problem. But if you look at the heat vulnerability index from the EPA, actually it's pretty high in Buffalo East Side area. Yeah, so some study shows that the reason probably because, for example, in like the south area of the United States, where people suffered by like high temperature, they may have high tolerance to high temperature because they have all their buildings are built to prevent this impact, right? They may have more air conditioning system in this area. But in Buffalo area, it's not traditionally hot or cold area.
Right.
So these buildings may not equipped with adequate facilities for that. And then people's like sensitivity is also pretty sensitive to small increase of temperature. So in that way, that the increase or the larger variability of temperature can make people more vulnerable in Buffalo area compared to other like southern area of the United States. That's the rationale behind it.
That's the rationale. And again, we don't have the results yet to totally understand that, but that's something that there is a certain amount of a thought that most certainly could be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how about for you, Samantha? I mean, there's so much to this. What else strikes you about the possibilities of what these studies could show?
I think it just reaffirms that everything is connected.
Right.
I think oftentimes in social determinants of health work, which is the work that I do, and similarly to what Dr. Wong and Dr. Yu are doing, is that if we confirm our hypothesis, right, that air quality is poor in these regions, then does that then build the argument that the reason we're seeing such high incidence of chronic illness, that we're seeing such high rates of food insecurity, that all of those things are connected? And then how do we mobilize air quality results into a transportation issue, right? So the work never stops, truly, but I think trying to figure out how we connect the results of these studies to all of the social determinants of health, right? There have been movements on, you know, gardening and growing our own food, but I also think pushing our municipals to plant more trees, right? The Maston District had a huge tree removal program. The city promised to replant those trees, but it's been incredibly slow. And so I'm sure trees have a huge impact on things like our heat index, right? So it can be sometimes 10 degrees hotter outside of tree shade and tree coverage. We know famously that trees take in the things that we don't want and release the things that we do. And so I think these studies have the potential to connect more of our social determinants of health work, again, not just for our physical environment, but for our built environment as well. So all of the things that we are doing, trying to, you know, all of these new like housing buildings that are coming up, right? What are we doing about the houses that need lead remediation or need their pipes replaced? And how will that then affect our community down the line? I think what's really special about Dr. Wong's study is that although the focus is seniors, there are multi-generational homes all across the city, right? So what you do that affects seniors will also affect younger generations. It's not just going to affect this one person in their home.
Then just to jump on that, and we only touched on it briefly, about the focus on seniors in your study, Dr. Wong. Again, what is the impetus for that?
The implicate, so do you mean like a why?
Why seniors and not just a general, not any homeowner, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, when we talk about environmental exposure, we typically focus on vulnerable population because they may not be well prepared, right? So vulnerable population include like elder participants, like pregnant women or kids or like infants, right? So in my study, I typically interested in elderly participants. One reason is because my research trajectory is related to aging population. So I'm more interested in like how environmental factors could impact the aging population. So that's along with my research interest. But also because I want to understand like on the east side, so how we can, my technology can help improve this the health for this typical group of population. Yeah, like I said, so these people, they typically do not like moving outside, right? They have like moving issues. Sometimes they may not go to the green space, which is good for them, right? Go outside, getting some fresh air. And also they may not really get like intermediate information from social media, for example, to understand, okay, there's a problem now. So that is why like my initiation is trying to help them, like figuring out strategies, helping them to get rid of this issue.
We're talking about air quality in the city of Buffalo, specifically on the east side. Our guest today on What's Next, Dr. Meng Wong from the University of Buffalo, and also Samantha Hidalgo from the Buffalo Center for Health Equity. We'll get more into the studies, more about the recruitment of people who may want to be interested in participating in the studies, and we'll have more coming up on What's Next. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
This is Jack Cruiser with the scoreboard on WBFO. Listen during Morning Edition and All Things Considered each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for the latest on pro matchups and college rivalries, as well as standout local athletes from Western New York and Southern Ontario. Want more? Listen to a longer version of the scoreboard at WBFO.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Celebrate the 50th anniversary season of Austin City Limits. Don't miss remarkable performances from Gary Clark Jr., Black Pumas, Brittany Howard, and more. Watch every Monday at 10 p.m. on WNED PBS.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. Our guest this morning, Samantha Hidalgo, and also Dr. Meng Wong. Dr. Wong with the University of Buffalo, their Department of Epidemiology and Environmental Health, and with us also Samantha Hidalgo, who is the Public Health Program Manager at the Buffalo Center for Health Equity. If you're just joining us, a couple of different studies are going on the east side specifically. Actually, Dr. Wong in the break told me there's a lot of studies going on around the city of Buffalo, but we're more focused on the east side right now. And with that, Samantha, you need participants to take part in these programs. Let's talk about recruitment efforts, who you're looking for, and what the commitment would be for somebody who wanted to participate in either of these studies.
Absolutely. I think, first and foremost, our organization has always been and continues to be committed to ensuring that research is equitable. There is a lot of mistrust throughout the city with different researchers, doctors, institutions at large. And so our job is not necessarily to make those fears go away, but to try to build trust as much as we can. So for Dr. Yu's outdoor air quality study, the requirements are pretty simple. You have to live in one of the priority target areas, which is 14215, 212, 211, 203, did I forget anything? and to have an outdoor outlet, which has honestly been the biggest barrier, is that with housing stock as old as ours, not every house has an outdoor outlet. But if people are willing, they have extension cords that we can run from garages or basements or homes outside for the sensor. The research team installs the sensor. You just have to have Wi-Fi to connect the sensor to the cloud, and then that's pretty much it. The research team comes in about 3 to 4 times a year just to check in on the sensor. If you so choose, you can download an app that shows you the readings of the sensor. So the sensor's probably 4 or 5 inches tall, okay. 4 or 5 inches across. It's really small. They just ask that you don't put it anywhere near like a barbecue or a fire pit if you have something like that. It might skew the data a little bit. You're compensated for the entire year. Okay. I think you get a payment of about $160. They say that the sensor requires about $1 worth of electricity every month. So subtract 12 from that. You're making quite a bit of profit, but it's a relatively simple thing to be a
part
of. No
real maintenance involved.
No, you don't have to worry about the sensor. You don't have to really do much of anything. unless, you know, something happens to the sensor. But even then, if it's connected to Wi-Fi, it should alert the research team that, you know, something has happened. We're hoping to recruit about another 15 to 16 households before the end of the year. Again, you have the sensor for one full year, and then we're looking for another cohort about a year from now to do the same thing, essentially.
All right. And Dr. Wong, for your indoor study, what are the, I guess, who are the people that you're looking for, and what, you know, what would they have to do to become part of the study?
Yeah, so we are typically interested in elderly participants who are aged more than 55 years old, or if, like, we can lower down to 50 if people are also concerning about their indoor air quality. So we only have one requirement, that is they need to have a Wi-Fi available at home. So we don't have, like, a very strict restriction. So as long as they are concerned about air quality and they want to participate, so they are welcome to join our study. And in this study, we will provide two things. So one is a small air sensor as well. So the air sensor is typically put indoor, and the sensor is also small, like a smartphone size.
Okay.
And there's a dashboard in front that can show you the reading of the air quality level, with color indicating whether the level is good or not. So green color indicate a good quality, and yellow color indicate like concerning air quality, need to be concerned, and then red color really meaning that they need to do something. So that is the air sensor, and we will also provide a smart plug, and then also our team will build up a DIY air purifier to the participants. Yep.
And how many participants are you looking for?
So we are looking for 30 participants in total within 1 year.
And
the study will be following up them up for 6 months.
Okay.
And they will also get monetary incentives for
How goes the recruitment so far? Are you just getting started?
Yeah, we are just getting started. We are figuring out the strategy with Samantha from the Buffalo Center for Health Equity to help us.
Is the outreach going to be on your shoulders?
I also want to make sure that we talk that you don't have to live in a home. If you live in an apartment.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah,
no, that's okay. Yeah. For Dr. Wong's study, you can live in an apartment because we have a lot of seniors that live in apartments or senior facilities. They are also welcome to participate. You don't have to live solely in a home or in a two-family home. You can live in an apartment building as well.
Information at your website?
Yep, BuffaloHealthEquity.com.
And we'll most certainly repeat that before we're all said and done. You brought up a topic, and I'm curious if you want to expand on this, about mistrust of institutions.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about the city of Buffalo. That's where our program focuses on, the city of Buffalo. Can we talk about that a little bit? Maybe what you've encountered in that regard?
Sure. I think our elders that I've encountered are not quick to let me forget that there's still a lot of mistrust still exists in our communities, and I will always take the time to listen to that. My background actually is in research. Before I joined the Center for Health Equity, I worked at Roswell recruiting for human subjects research, which I loved, and I don't know if I'll ever go back, but I like what I do now, kind of interfacing with research this way. And I think so much of what I've heard is, well, we never hear anything back. They come in, they take their survey. Sometimes we get money, sometimes we don't. And then they leave, and that's it. We never know what happens next. And in all of the conversations that I've had related to Dr. Wong and Dr. Yu's studies, I'm like, that's not going to happen, right? Dr. Yu has committed to having a public database of the results of this study. And our job as part of the dissemination plan for both of these studies is to go back into community to talk about what these results mean and what it means to move forward with these results. We are very much of the mindset that research is meant to be shared. It's meant to be disseminated to communities that it concerns. It's not just meant to stay in a filing cabinet for 15 years until somebody needs to cite it in a PhD or another research paper, right? And so I welcome conversation around with anybody about how we can make research more equitable for communities of color, particularly. I mean, you've got very famous examples of mistreatment from Tuskegee, you know, and then not to say that anything that drastic is happening today, but there are still researchers that could be doing more to make communities feel more comfortable. One of the things that I think is more positive coming outside of UB and funders at large is that there is now, in some open calls, a requirement to have a community-based partner, right? Your research will not get funded unless you have a CBO or NGO that's directly involved in the design, dissemination, recruitment at every level of the research. And so part of the open call for Dr. Wong's study was that. And so he reached out to us, pitched the idea, and we were 100% on board, in part because him and his team made us not only feel welcome, but showed this real commitment to having us be a part of the design. We've talked about what the survey looks like. There, we've seen the questions. There's not anything in there that we kind of red flagged. We may have changed the wording on a few things, but having, I think, a partner that's willing to be in community too, that's the other thing, is like researchers kind of sometimes stay in their lofty towers. They send an intern out and then you never really see them. Both Dr. Yu and Dr. Wong have been in community. Like, they are very forward-facing. Dr. Yu, I know it, we were with the Taxpayers Association for the Northland Taxpayers Association, the meeting there. She gave everyone her email, right? You don't really see that very often from a PI who's in charge of, you know, a pretty big grant. And so I think for us, like, we want research to be as equitable as possible because we know we need it. Unfortunately, we do. Right. We need investigators to look into things that we can't just prove with anecdotal evidence in order for whether it be the government, local, city, or federal to pay attention to, right? And so it's kind of mobilizing our community members to not only feel welcome in research settings, but to know that we need them, right?
Right.
Research doesn't happen without community.
Dr. Wong, I'm curious maybe about your experience, past experience. Again, we'll try to let the results of your study show for themselves in the future. But when you heard Samantha talking about there, and I saw you nodding your head a couple times, have you seen some of those issues, not necessarily here with this study, but other research that you've done where building trust or like Samantha indicated that in some cases, you know, they came in, they did their study, and we never heard anything about it. I guess you've developed a sensitivity to those types of issues?
Yeah, so I think that's a very important issue. So I would say that from the perspective of researchers, our starting point initially is to understand like basic science questions rather than like really targeting to community problems at the beginning. So previously my research is more like border focused, like nationwide study looking at air pollution effect, different type of health effect. So the problem of that is that we can address like the scientific problem, but the problem may not be easily translated into policy making, I would say, like to help really benefit to people. So that is the problem. So then when there's a scope moving forward to collaborate with community partners, the good thing is that for scientists, we can really think about the need from local community. Sometimes it may force us to think differently from people. So for example, we are just thinking about, okay, whether we can deploy air monitors in people's home. Yeah, we put 30 monitors, 60 monitors, but we don't really think about whether how community partners think about this, right? They may think differently of what we want, right? Sometimes they, I don't know how to say that, but I think from their scope, they may not really concerning about the sense problem, but they may care about their local problem more than scientific problem. So that's when we need to reshape our focus, leveraging our experience, the research experience, but more applicable to solve the local problem.
Right.
Yeah. So and also I think back to the mistrust issue. So when we design the study, definitely we hope to increase the retention rate in our study. We hope that we can follow people over time without any dropout. So in that sense, from the scientific viewpoint, so we make forever trying to do that.
Right. Yeah. And I saw you, Samantha, kind of nodding also quite vigorously as Dr. Wong was speaking about, understanding what that's going to be like. I guess it's easy to just say, we're going to put a monitor in your house. It's another thing to, you're putting a monitor in my house. Yeah. So what about that?
I think 100% of what Dr. Wong said in that, like, researchers, rightfully or wrongfully so, are just like, they're focused on the scientific question, right? Like, they want the answer to it. And I think part of what our work is kind of translating some of that very scientific, very academic talk into just layman's terms, right? And I think there is effort, particularly definitely within Dr. Yu and Dr. Wong's study, but at large, like, there are certain, requirements that you have to have. So, like, a consent form has to be at least a sixth grade to eighth grade reading level, right? So that people who don't have, you know, college degrees are able to understand. But it's got to be more than that, right? Mm. It can't just be that the way we talk about it is, I explain the study to you for 15 minutes. I say, okay, you got everything? Good, great, we're going to get started, right? We have to leave time for questions. We have to leave time for comments. Dissemination, I think, is a growing field in which we could be putting a lot more community efforts for research, in that, okay, it's great that UB just won, you know, multi-million dollar grant, but what's the community impact of that? I think with institutions like the Community Health Equity Research Institute, there is this push for researchers, again, to be more community facing. Institutions kind of across the country, I think, are paying more attention to the fact that research needs to be a collaborative effort between community and researcher, and that researchers have to be present in community. That's not to say that they have to be, you know, knocking on doors every day saying, we're here, we're reaffirming that. But I think knocking on a few doors doesn't hurt, right? Explaining that, like, you have a vested interest in what this community has to offer and their feedback, and that communities actually hold a ton of power, because if nobody shows up to partake in your study, then your question never gets answered.
So, like, on a personal note or from personal experience, you see a difference when, like you said, you actually go knock on doors as compared to, say, let's have a meeting at the community center.
Yeah, I think, not to knock either one, because you do get good feedback from people that are just kind of attending a community center meeting, but that community center has to be located.
But I guess maybe do you get a sense of what you're seeking, like trust? You're getting a better sense from that?
Absolutely. I think when you have small group meetings or just one-on-ones with whoever is in charge of a study, you get more recognition of your concerns, right? It's not just like a research intern who is doing this for credit and hours and resume and may have a vested interest, has to then, you know, take it up the chain to say, like, oh yeah, well, my PI said that was okay, you know? And so I think by having us kind of built in and weaved into not just the research plan, but even the application, right? Your ask for money from a big, you know, NIH institute or the CDC or the FDA or USDA, and having us not just embedded in, like, oh yeah, we're going to call on these people, but saying, like, oh, the Buffalo Center for Health Equity has, from the beginning of this concept of an idea to now, been involved in that whole process, I think strengthens your application.
Very good. We're going to take one more time out. We'll come back and finish up our discussion. We're talking about air quality here in the city of Buffalo, a couple of studies that are embarking upon a focus on the east side with us, Samantha Hidalgo and Dr. Meng Wong from the University of Buffalo. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Hey, parents and caregivers. Let Reading Rainbow Stories help your child stay on track with their studies. Teach your child to shatter stereotypes with amazing grace.
There's no doubt who would be Peter Pan. Everyone voted for Grace.
Yay!
You were fantastic, whispered Natalie.
Or about how bats and birds are different with Stella Luna.
Why are you hanging upside down? You're a bat. You're supposed to hang by your feet.
Or about how to preserve family legacies with a patchwork quilt.
Yes, your mama can get you a quilt from any department store, but it won't be like my patchwork quilt, and it won't last as long either.
Visit readingrainbow.org or the Reading Rainbow YouTube channel today.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community
And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed and connected to your community, whether it's by hearing from a local Black poet about what it was like to move from the inner city to the suburbs on What's Next.
So that emotional change with that culture change combined let me realize that basketball and being physical wasn't enough. I needed a way to figure out my emotions. So the first poem I wrote in the cafetorium was of Sweet Home Middle School was Outcast.
Or it's exploring the East Side Garden Walk.
It's wonderful that we're seeing engagement in beautification and sharing gardens, because we believe that we can build more vibrant communities by sharing our gardens, by sharing our stories, and by building real connections between people. We came through as neighbors and cleaned the space out and began plot by plot putting plants in.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. We're talking about air quality in the city of Buffalo. A couple of studies, one taking a look at exterior or outdoor air quality, another one taking a look at indoor air quality. And with us talking about it, we have Samantha Hidalgo, the public health program manager at the Buffalo Center for Health Equity, and also Dr. Meng Wong, associate professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Environmental Health at the University of Buffalo. And it is Dr. Wong who is focused on the interior air quality study. But a big part of this, of course, we touched upon this a little bit earlier about seniors and air quality. We're looking to find out about the specifics in the East Side and how that's why your study is is out there and doing this. But what about in general? What do we know when it comes to air quality and its impact on seniors? What do we know right now, and what would maybe we suspect to find as we move through the study?
Well, I think elderly participants is definitely a very vulnerable population to poor air quality nationwide in the United States. So, you know, NIH, for example, they have two big institutes. One is called NIA, another one is called NHBL. So they both support a large number of grant studies focusing on focusing on elderly participants' health. So the reason is that the environmental exposure or air quality problem is important to elderly participants. It's because these elderly participants, when they get aging, they get more and more chronic disease in progress. So, for example, they get a higher hypertension, more diabetes, and also some people may get like decline, like cognitive decline over time. So this progress, during this progress, making them more and more susceptible to air quality. So on one hand, air quality could accelerate this progress based on current researches. On the other hand, people who have this status could be more impacted by air quality. So on both sides, air quality is important for these elderly participants. And eventually, there's also many studies suggested that air quality could increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, increase risk of Alzheimer's disease, increase the risk of respiratory disease. And most of these diseases focused on elderly participants. So when we talk about back to air quality, specifically to PM2.5, you know that a recent Lancet report, which is the leading medical journal, they have ranked PM2.5 so PM2.5 used to be top 5 risk factor to cause mortality, but recently it has been ranked as the leading risk factor now. So That means that air quality is becoming more and more important for human subject, and specifically for elderly participants.
And so even before you go into the study, I mean, it's almost a call to action for individuals to be conscious of the possibility of air quality problems in their residence.
Yeah.
If, would you advise a senior resident to do one of those DIY air purifier systems that you're going to be using in this study?
Yes, kind of. Yeah. So I think now researchers, we are now thinking about different ways to help people improve indoor air quality. So definitely like air purifier is one strategy that has been emphasized by not only EPA, but also NIH many U.S. sponsors recommend doing that. But how to make use of it is a question, right? How to educate people to properly use this air purifier problem. So that's why we are trying to dealing with this problem by making use of a strategy like automatic progress to operate the air purifier.
Samantha, you mentioned before about dissemination and how you thought that there needs to be more focus on dissemination when it comes to studies and things along those lines. You've intrigued me with that, so I'm going to give you a chance to expand on it a little bit here.
Yeah, before I do that, I just wanted to highlight again what Dr. Wong said about air quality either accelerating progress or the opposite of is air quality causing
issues.
Chronic illness,
issues
with chronic illness? We have an incredibly high incident rate of chronic illness, particularly on the east side in our Black and Brown communities. And so if we are able to mitigate the factor of air quality, we will hopefully see an improvement in chronic illness.
Okay.
And so I think that that's huge in having these discussions, especially with seniors, because disability is an eventual thing, right? It's not something that we're just we'll never have disability. Whether you have a chronic illness or not, we do kind of break down as we get older. And so having the ability to mitigate air quality, I think, allows us to prolong that long-term disability. But back to dissemination, I think, and even that too is so huge, is recognizing within our community members and within social determinants of health work that it's all connected, right? You may not necessarily have a strong tie to air quality because your focus is putting food on the table, is trying to get your basic needs met, making sure your lights are on, the gas bill's paid, that you have all of your emergency preparedness kit for the winter. And so air quality may not necessarily be at the top of mind. And I think that's, again, where the connection with having a community-based partner is for research design, but also for dissemination is we now know that a DIY air purifier in either multi-generational or single-generation homes with elders, with seniors, saw a marked improvement than those who just had an air sensor. What do we do with that information? We're talking to other people in our community about how we need to be putting more of an attention on air quality, how we push. I know Dr. Wong had talked earlier about researchers not always knowing that translation to policy change, right? That's where a CBO like ours and our partners can fit in. Okay, what's something that we have to get on the community agenda so that we can pitch it to the city or pitch it to the county or pitch it to the state that has an impact not only in our communities, but statewide, right? If Buffalo is not the only city that has, a large African-American Black population in one specific section of the city that tends to have poor health outcomes. That's not a story that's unique to us. And so when we're talking about things like dissemination, it's mobilizing that feeling and emotion, that anger, that power towards something productive, right? We knock on doors, we host community meetings, we, put out a white paper. I think rightfully so, researchers want their research to be published, but that can't just be the only goal of dissemination.
Right. And when it comes to research, final question for you here, Dr. Wong. I know you're still recruiting people to be part of this, but how long do you anticipate from start to finish for this project?
Yeah. So now this project is a pilot study. So the period is 1 year period.
Okay.
So we hope to recruit people in the first half of the year and then finish it by the end of the next, maybe by the beginning of next fall. So that is a period of the study. So we So based on this study, we will analyze this data to demonstrate that air purifier is effective, our technology is good, and also to demonstrate that we need to be careful of air quality in Buffalo East Side area. So based on all this information, on one side we can translate this information to community partner, letting them know that what's their issue and whether we can do something to help them. On the other hand, we want to make use of this data to expand it to larger area, more population, larger grant to have more impactful study in this area.
So a lot to come in that regard.
Right.
And then, of course, as we mentioned, Dr. Wong is focused on indoor air quality. There's another study that's focused on outdoor air quality and still recruiting applicants for both. Let's make sure that we put our call to action out here before we say goodbye, Samantha. How should people proceed?
Yeah, check us out on our website, buffalohealthequity.com. We'll have information on both of the studies, both indoor and outdoor. To the question about timeline for outdoor, we still have at least another two and a half years of just collecting data, and then probably a few more months after that before the study will be, you know, ready for dissemination. But we'll keep updates on our website for both of the studies.
Okay, so that's the place to go to find out more. Well, Dr. Meng Wong, thank you very much for joining us today. Samantha Hidalgo, thanks for being with us as well. What's next? Samantha is public health program manager for the Buffalo Center for Health Equity, Dr. Meng Wong, with the Department of Epidemiology and Environmental Health at the University of Buffalo. This is What's Next on WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.